Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
If you're struggling with drugs, alcohol, gambling or food, or concerned about somebody who is, tune in to the Living Free show on 3CR at 1 p.m. every Thursday.
I don't know how I got there, but and I couldn't stop it.
I had stopped expecting that anybody cared.
Never enough. I'm never enough. It's never enough. He's never enough.
That was the confusion.
Tune in to Living Free, stories of recovery from addictive behaviour, Thursdays at 1 p.m. on 3CR. Or listen at 3CR on digital radio or podcasts and live streaming on 3cr.org.au.
Being able to centre myself and be okay in myself and turn my world around.
Living Free. Welcome to the Living Free show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 kilohertz on your AM dial. I'm Anne, and with co-host Mitch today, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay respects to our elders past and present and to acknowledge that sovereignty over this land was never ceded. Each week on the Living Free show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drug, alcohol, gambling, food and other addictions. Our guests share their recovery stories and highlight that shared experience saves lives. Today the focus is on Al-Anon family groups. Al-Anon is a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength and hope in order to solve their common problems. Al-Anon believes that alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. This week I'm joined by Dan, a member of Al-Anon and a former member of Al-Ateen. So we're going to have a bit of an Al-Ateen perspective today. Dan thinks it's important that we get that message out, that there is a fellowship there for young people whose life's affected by someone's drinking. So welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome, Mitch.
Hello, good to be here.
Let's start, Dan, by just tell us about your life, your early life, where you were growing up.
Well, I grew up in Melbourne. I grew up in Ivanhoe. My parents split when I was maybe 4 years old, and I really had no consciousness of alcohol in my life. I really up until the point when I was a teenager, but I came from a somewhat broken home, I would say. My parents did the very best that they could with what they had, but nevertheless, you know, it was in many ways a rich childhood, but one that was blighted by the presence of alcohol within the home. So that's why I'm here today, I suppose.
So how did that manifest?
Well, I mean, it was somewhat of a confusing thing because when you're a kid, you really don't have any understanding of alcohol at all. Mm. So what would take place is everyone would be more or less normal. The parents would be normal during the day. But then what would happen is, you know, at nighttime, you would wake up to these horrific fights taking place. And what had taken place is that, you know, there had been a substitution between, in my case, one of my parents, who was a loving, nurturing parent during the day. But then when they would drink, would sort of transform. And so when you're young, you haven't the capacity to make sense of what's going on here. All you know is that there's a radical unpredictability to the way your family life proceeds. So, yeah, that has a kind of impact that I'm sure we'll talk about.
And that use of the word transform, that's interesting. So what did it kind of look like when their personality would shift at night?
Well, it's hard to describe. I mean, it's hard to describe if you haven't seen it. And what really takes place when you're drinking alcohol, of course, is that there's the inhibition of all your sort of more benevolent ways of thinking and acting. And if you've got a whole bunch of trauma and brokenness in your life, as one of my parents did, a lot of that can come out and manifest itself in various different ways. So, but in general, you know, if a parent is prone to anger or violence, that might come out. If they're prone to hysteria, that might come out as well. It sort of depends on the individual person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and reflecting on, I guess, that divorce, was that something that troubled you when you were going to school and high school and that kind of thing, or how did you come to terms with that?
It's hard to say. I mean, when you're a kid, you really don't sit around thinking about these sorts of things too much. So I, in many ways, I had a very, very strong relationship with both my parents, even though they were split up. So I'm extremely fortunate to have that. But at the same time, you know, as you get into your teenage years, you might feel that there's a sort of lack of stability or a lack of security or predictability around your life. And that might come out, in my case, with a lot of anger or a lot of estrangement, frustration. Yeah.
And you said when you were younger, you didn't really have a perception of alcohol per se until you got into your teenage years. Mm. What did that start to look like when you did understand or start to understand the impact of alcohol in your family?
Well, I really only began to understand that alcohol was the problem when the alcoholic parent got sober. And that parent would go to meetings, would go to AA. And I could see the transformation in that parent's life. And so it was really through coming to see the beauty of this new person that was going through recovery that I came to understand that a lot of the muck and the brokenness of the past was due to the substance.
Can I take you back then to were you the only child?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah. So can you tell me what your reaction was either in behavior or in thinking or feeling with the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde situation?
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. So what you're alluding to there is, yeah, exactly. The fact that, you know, your parent or depending on what the case is, it could be any other family member, but in my case, it was a parent, seeming to manifest two different sorts of personalities. And I suppose my response was to generalize to the view that the world is radically unpredictable and that people can be one way and then turn out to be another way.
Mm-hmm.
And so naturally, if you're in that sort of situation, how are you going to trust people? How are you going to form a stable relationship with the better aspects of people's natures around you, but also at the same time, bear in mind that people are complicated and that they might have other aspects to their personality that you don't like. It's very difficult to have an integrated point of view on someone, is what I'm trying to say. You tend to see people as all good or all bad because it's hard to trust people when they're unpredictable.
I remember an auntie during a party at our house came and sat on my bed and was just chatting to me about something, and she'd had a drink, but I would have been about 10, and I had no idea the difference between having had a drink and being blotto, completely drunk. So she's talking, and I'm just looking at her with absolutely no trust whatsoever. Like, I was given a nothing, you know, it's like, because I don't trust any adult at all who'd been drinking, and it took me a long time to sort through that.
Yeah. I feel like trust is built through becoming adjusted to consistent personalities.
Mm-hmm.
Or consistent personality type.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're faced with something that's totally unfamiliar, it's like, how can you?
Mm. Okay, so did you do anything like, did you actually get involved with, did you get up and try and sort the problem out that you were listening to?
You've got to remember that I'm a child here.
Yeah.
I'm 6 or 7 years old. I always had an extremely... I was very, very apt to defend this parent, sometimes physically. So I remember, I don't remember this actually. I've been told that we were at a party one time, me and this parent. And I'm saying this parent rather than my mother or my father because I'm trying to preserve
Are they both still together at this point?
No, they're not. But I was at this party and I'm 3 years old or something like that. And my parent is hit in the head by a golf ball, which someone was whacking around for some reason at a party. And apparently as a three-year-old, I marched off there screaming at this person, ready to attack them.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, again, there was this kind of chivalric desire to defend this parent. So, yeah, I mean, my reaction typically was to try and seize control and to defend and protect.
And that is a completely that's goes to the heart of what it is to be the child of an alcoholic, because that's a completely natural reaction, but it's something that most children don't have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And did your parents put you in the middle at any point, or would tell you something and tell you not to tell the other parents?
No. Very, very fortunately, my parents were in their separation as good as honestly you could ever hope two parents to be. They always put me at the center of their concern. And that, in a way, that kind of love for me helped preserve their kind of relationship, not as a couple, but as co-parents throughout that time. So, I'm extremely grateful that could take place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, isn't it, that somebody can be damaged and in one way, but enlightened in another way. And that's another thing, thinking about growing up in an alcoholic situation. It's not all bad because these people are not bad people.
Yes,
they've just got a problem.
Exactly.
Something else I wanted to touch on, just on what we were talking about before as well, is, you know, when you're one person during the day and another person at night when you drink, I feel like that's almost become normalized as a part of drinking. You know, oh, you know, that's Stacey, she's not like me, she's the crazy drunk, and people almost palm it off in terms of having to take accountability for their actions when they're drunk through virtue of adopting a new personality.
Yeah.
And I feel like, yeah, that's just so normalized, and people joke about it, but it really can turn into something negative and consuming like that as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Can we take you to your teenage years now? So you talked before about a sense of estrangement and anger, I think you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
How was that for you?
Well, it was, as it sounds, estrangement and anger. I mean, to some extent, that's part of the teenage experience, no doubt. But at the same time, I think that when you go through a childhood such as mine, you've got a lot of problems to sort out by the time you get to your teenage years, and life doesn't stop in order for you to sit there and sort things out.
Mm-hmm.
The changes keep on coming, the responsibilities keep on building, and you have to make sense of those as best you can on your own, really. That's the challenge.
And what was school like for you?
Well, it was good in many ways, but it was also challenging in that I have a disability, I'm vision impaired. So, you know, there was this added challenge of the fact that I was losing my vision over the time that I was a child and a teenager. And so I had to manage that at the same time as sort of managing what was going on at home. And so I suppose my response was to really not engage with school, to sort of break away with it. I used to wag. Fortunately, I you know, I had music and heavy metal, which I discovered at a certain point in time, which kind of protected me and gave me a kind of identity for a period of time. So,
does it mean you were in the school band, so that was the reason to get into school, or do you just mean it was something to engage you, your soul?
Well, I was, in the end, in just about every single musical project the school offered. But yeah, I was also in other bands, heavy metal bands. But the point is, you know, I just loved the music that I played. I loved the music that I was listening to. It gave me a sense of purpose. It's something that I genuinely had a connection with. So,
yeah,
you know, there was solace in that.
Why do you think you were drawn to metal? What was it initially, if you can try and make sense of that?
Yeah, it's very difficult to say, because when I first heard metal, it just connected with me in a way that that made sense. And I can't really be any more articulate than that, because it's somewhat ineffable when music really connects for you. But for me, what it was a genuine and raw expression of a range of different sort of human emotions, including anger and frustration and all those sorts of things. But what I saw in metal was both a great love of the technique behind music, a love for the craft of music, but at the same time, a sort of willingness to be able to be angry or write a metal ballad and display a range of different sorts of emotions with a certain sort of musical integrity, which I really spoke to me.
Right. So not only is it okay to be angry, it's kind of like empowering.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I suppose at the end of the day, it's not necessarily about the emotion you're expressing. It's the fact that you're trying to express yourself with a certain sort of authenticity, and you're trying to make the music about something that is real in your character, real in your life, real in your emotions. And when you can do that, it takes a certain amount of courage to do that. But when you can do that, and when you connect with someone, it builds a real kind of relationship.
That's great to hear you talk about that authenticity, because I think one of the things that I came out of the alcoholic situation that I grew up in with was a sense of not being able to express myself authentically, different era. And also it was more shameful. So there was a whole part of me that was not expressed because I was hiding the fact that my household was so dysfunctional. So that's very encouraging to hear that happened. Can you take us, before we're going to a break in a minute, can you take us to the point where you decided to go to an Alateen meeting?
Yes. My mother convinced me somehow, I still don't remember how, but to go to a meeting at some point. And I think the only reason I went is because that day I bought my first Megadeth album, which was a classic metal band. I always heard that. And I think I went with the intention of like putting my iPod headphones in my ears and covering my ears with my hair. The audience can't see, but I've got long hair. And sort of sitting there as I did in class and sort of wagging by just listening to music and not paying attention. So I thought, this is going to be fine. You know, I can sort of absent myself. But I got there and I was told that I can't listen to my iPod, which was somewhat disappointing. And yeah, but that I had the experience of my first ever Alateen meeting. And again, just to pick up on that theme of authenticity, that's one of the first things I experienced in the rooms. So, yeah.
We'll come back to that after the break. Yeah. We've got some music that Dan's brought in. Now, Dan told me before the show that his great love is classical music and his other love is death metal and forms of metal, and he's now selected, believe it or not, Steely Dan. So can you tell us why?
Well, I love Steely Dan. I really, really love Steely Dan. So it's not as if I'm choosing music that I'm not a fan of.
Yes,
but
yes,
at the same time, you know, I was thinking about which Beethoven piano sonata to select, and I sort of thought, oh, perhaps there's music that might be of a greater appeal to a wider audience.
Good on you.
Who doesn't like Steely Dan?
Exactly. So,
this is Reeling in the Years by Steely Dan.
You or someone you care for is struggling with a mental illness or other disability, and you need someone to talk to, you can call the Wellways Helpline. Wellways Helpline is a volunteer support and referral service that provides information to people experiencing mental health issues or other disabilities, as well as their family, friends and carers. We're here to talk if you are feeling socially isolated, seeking information about mental health or mental health services, or just need someone to talk to. As a peer-based service, everyone working at Wellways Helpline has a lived experience of mental health issues or disability. Wellways Helpline is a national service and operates Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m, excluding public holidays. So if you're struggling yourself or are struggling to help someone else, please call Wellways Helpline on 1-300-111-500. That's 1-300-111-500. Wellways supports 3CR.
This is a Living Free Show on 3CR 855 kHz on your AM radio dial and 3CR on digital radio. If you would like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone, email or Twitter or the new community radio app. I'm talking today with Dan, who attended Alateen, is now a member of Al-Anon, and he's just going to talk to us a little bit more now about what Alateen was like. So welcome back, Dan.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, so what convinced you, said you went to your first meeting at your mum's urging. Why did you give in to the urging? What made sense to you?
Well, going? I really can't for the life of me remember why I actually went to the first meeting, to be honest. I don't know what sort of schemes she employed to get me there. But I did go. And I suppose really the question is, what kept me coming back?
Yeah, that's
and
it.
The experience that I had there was ultimately of being able to express oneself about the experience of growing up around alcoholism and to not fear any kind of judgment or reprisal on the part of other people. And at the same time, what happens when you can do that is first and foremost, you feel this unburdening of oneself. You feel, I felt that the pain that I had been living with for such a long time wasn't necessarily something I had to carry, and it wasn't something that would be alien to other people. So when I met the other Alateens, people my age, who I later became friends with, I realized that, you can have a friendship grounded in that kind of honesty where you can reveal that aspect of your life to someone, and that can be productive of a friendship and a connection with someone. So I think first and foremost, it was that experience and then the kinds of relationships and the wisdom that I was able to imbibe through Alateen.
So those kinds of relationships that you formed in Alateen, you didn't have anything like that during school, or how did you go reaching out to people about those kinds of topics during school?
Yeah, look, I was very, very lucky to have some solid friendships in school. But the thing was, because my mates didn't have any real experience of alcoholism, it wasn't something that they could really relate to. And, at times I'd have a mate over to stay the night, and my alcoholic parent would start fighting with her then husband, which was not my father, but it was the person she had remarried with. But you're in this situation where you've got a mate over. They've never really been around something like this. They come from a pretty secure home, and you're sort of trying to explain to them, like, oh, this is kind of normal. Like, this will happen from time to time. It's you know, it's fine. It's not gonna result in violence or murder. Contrary to
chill,
you know, chill basically. So, yeah, but that was always very difficult because it was, you know, quite embarrassing, really. But yeah, then you start to make, if you go to Alateen, if you're lucky enough to go to Alateen, as I was, you start to make friends for whom that kind of experience was not so alien. So, yeah.
And reaching out online, or did you Google things like that?
No, I was not very online then, and I'm still not now. So yeah. So it was all face-to-face.
It's also quite a while back, really, when you think that. So this is, you were about 15, right?
When I went to Alateen, I was about 15 or 16. And yeah. I'm 28 now, so yeah.
Okay, yeah. What's that? So like 13 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, yep.
It wasn't.
There was some message boards around, you know, your Reddits and stuff like that. But definitely the conversation around speaking up and that kind of thing was nowhere near as prevalent as it is now.
No. All right, so you said you imbibed a bit of wisdom there from these other kids.
Yes. Well, and the program as well.
Yeah.
You know, it all comes through the program.
Yeah, and through the kids, though, too.
Yes, they reflect that back to you in their own ways. Yes.
So what did you learn? Can you think of anything in particular you learned at the time that you went, whoa, that is going to be very useful?
Yeah. Well, I think that the thing that really attracted me was the slogans initially. So the slogans are just these short sayings which contain little nuggets of wisdom, you know, like live and let live, or think, or... how important is it? Or let go and let God. And those slogans really, really helped me. So, you know, how important is it, for instance? You know, I think that to myself in some form pretty much every day these days, you know.
Mm. And do you think you were drawn to those kinds of things through virtue of being a philosophy student or...?
Well, my experience in Alateen preceded my interest in philosophy. And I would say that it's more the other way around. I had a kind of philosophical disposition in that I love to think, I love to... muse over the deep questions of life. But when I started going to Alateen meetings, I had a bit of a sort of platform from which to speak at every meeting. And I quickly found that I enjoyed speaking. And so that sort of led to my interest in some ways in philosophy, because philosophy is an area in which really the job is to in many situations, to sit around and to speak with other people about important ideas, difficult ideas. And so my first experience of that really in many ways was Alateen.
I'm going to jump right ahead up to your adult life now. Mm. You say you use how important is it every day.
Mm.
Is that because you've got a propensity to think things are more important than they are often? Is that a problem that you face every
day? Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think having a lack of proportionality is probably part of the human condition in some ways, because we don't ultimately think of things in terms of perspective. We don't tend to think of things in terms of what's this going to matter to me on my deathbed. We get very easily caught up with the small things that take place in our day-to-day lives. And so, yeah, the concept of how important is it, that's a piece of wisdom that you'll find in Al-Anon and Alateen, but it really goes back to the earliest works of philosophy. You'll find that in Stoic philosophy. You'll find that in Christianity. You'll find that all around the place in Buddhism. So yes, so really, it is a kind of a way of healing the lack of proportionality we have as humans in our the way we frame our days and our problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm. We're going to go a bit more philosophical than normal. What is it about humans, the human condition, that makes us blow things out of proportion? Is it will you tell me what you think?
Well, I think it's because we don't have our eyes on the true, the good, and the beautiful, the most abstract principles that govern the world and govern our lives and govern our thought. And so really, those terms there, they're really just synonyms for the concept of God within a sort of more traditional classical framework. Mm-hmm. But to bring this back down to earth, really, the main thing is that we get caught up in our day-to-day lives. We tend to think that the things that are going to satisfy us, you know, if we just get that job or that car or that girlfriend, if we impress this group of people, that's the moment we'll be ultimately satisfied.
Mm.
But it's never the case, is it?
Nope.
You get the job, you get the experience, you get this and you get that, and you're still left with this hunger. And the problem is that hunger is desiring something that's infinite. It's infinitely greater than anything we could have here on this earth. So... essentially, that's the problem of philosophy in a nutshell. Aristotle says that philosophy begins in wonder, and that's the same urge to understand, to understand, to understand. So it's our inability to come to terms with that aspect of our nature that leads us into clinging on to these problems in our day-to-day lives.
Just got two questions about that, if I could jump in. So, first of all, your relationship with religion and how you kind of formed that growing up, and also how did your relationship with philosophy affect your relationship with religion and the way you considered those kinds of theories and teachings?
Yeah, well, I was an atheist for many years. I really became a kind of anti-theist in my teenage years. I was very, very against any kind of religion. But fortunately, I, in my early university days, spent probably more time reading fiction, classic fiction, than I did studying philosophy, even though I worked very hard at my degree. And so I encountered the great works of the West, Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, Tolstoy's War and Peace, George Eliot's Middlemarch, all these Shakespeare, all these great works that really gave me a more informed understanding of the human condition. And part of that understanding speaks to this, as I was saying before, this desire that we have for the infinite in some form that we constantly try and fill with other sorts of things. It might be, sensual goods. It might be political programs. It could be anything else. So I began to realize that there was a lack in many of the secular philosophies that I was giving my allegiance to at that point in time. And then I started to study the great cosmological arguments for God's existence, how a finite, contingent world could have come into being, how a purely physical world could have brought itself into being from nothing. And eventually I came rather, over a long period of time and with lots of intellectual resistance, to concede that ultimately something like the monotheistic God given us in the Abrahamic religions makes far more sense at an intellectual level. But that really was an intellectual affair. Then began a deeper sort of emotional searching to see if actually this was something I could embrace and live in any significant way whatsoever. And that was much more difficult over time. Yeah.
We might put on another Steely Dan tune in a minute, less than a minute, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk about the hunger for the infinite and how you... how that plays out in your daily life.
If you join CoPower, you get to decide where 100% of our revenue goes. So while we work to dismantle the whole broken energy market, our members are building the world they want to live in by supporting strike funds, renewables projects, anti-poverty initiatives, and much more. So change your power company and then start changing everything else. That's what CoPower is all about.
Victorian energy fact sheets and basic plan information documents are available at cooperativepower.org.au. For clear advice on the right plan for you, contact us on 03 9068 6036.
A 3CR supporter.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
This is a Living Free show on 3CR Digital Radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. And we're talking with Dan about recovery from the effects of being close to someone with a problem of alcoholism. Dan, you used a phrase, or at least I made a phrase out of some things you said, and that phrase was hunger for the infinite, to describe the feeling of pursuing what you desire and then finding that you're still left with the hunger.
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit more, how that manifests in your adult life.
Well, I mean, we're very deep in the philosophical weeds now, aren't we? But, it's a yearning for something that is greater than any finite or incomplete good that we can find in this world. So, again, I think the best way to understand this is just to observe one's own experience, to see the ebbs and flows of desire for a new job or for this particular status in society or this particular musical achievement or academic achievement or something like that. What tends to happen is we get these achievements. We have a brief moment where we stand at the top of the mountain and then we wonder what it's all about. And there's an interesting phenomenon that can take place where at the moment of consummation, at the moment where you get something, at the moment where you feel happiest and you think, great, I finally got that job, or I got the top grade on this particular assignment, that experience can be tinged with a kind of a sadness or a kind of, but isn't there something more? Isn't there something more to this? And so, again, I think to observe that there is a hunger for the infinite, to observe that the finite goods of this world don't ultimately satisfy us, is really just it's good anthropology. It's just a good look at how we tend to work psychologically as humans, apart from anything else that it is. It's a metaphysical speculation.
suppose it's all, like you kind of said, it's all about your own perspective. You know, some people, one man's trash is another man's treasure, for instance, and some people are completely content in their own existence and getting that promotion or not getting the promotion. But yeah, I guess the longing for more is what kind of eats you up.
Well, that's the thing. It's that no matter what it is that you're actually pursuing, if it's a part of this world, it tends not to be enough. It will not be enough is what I believe. So, and I think you can observe this in the artistic arena. I mean, I love great music. I love great works of art. I love great literature. And when you're reading a great novel by Tolstoy or Proust or something like that, you can be swept up into this seemingly infinite sphere of beauty. But again, at the same time, it doesn't last. You can't fully join yourself with that moment. You can't fully fade into the Beethoven symphony. I hope you understand what I mean here. When you're viewing a beautiful, idyllic sunset, there's some sense in which you just want to merge with it. It's calling to you.
You can't own it.
No, but you can't. You can't. It's temporal and it fades. So that's the hunger for the infinite coming out.
Now, I've got that very, very strongly, and I don't know whether it's to do with personality or alcoholism. So I'm going to go to you, Mitch. I'm going to say, is that something you have? This yearning, longing all the time.
Yeah, I totally was resonating with what you were saying as well. I think for me, it's always, okay, this is something that I am aware of in terms of being taken away to another place when I'm connecting with beautiful art. But also in the last few years, the more I kind of learn about how art is made or the behind the scenes part of things, which I'm very interested in, the more I look at it from like an analytical and a critical point of view. And I guess I've lost kind of the magic of watching something not critically and kind of just going along for the ride and letting it take you away. So that's something I almost have to tap into my childlike sense of curiosity to really enjoy things nowadays. Mm.
So, Dan, I'm going to get you, because people have probably tuned in to hear about alcoholism. So can we take that idea, that hunger for the infinite, can you connect that up with the 12 steps and or the experience of alcoholism?
Yes, yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, it's really interesting to connect these two ideas together, because in the 12-step programs, what do you have? You have the idea that our powerlessness to control a given substance or alcohol, or it might be the consumption of alcohol in another person, our powerlessness is something that we need to confront. So what do you do when you discover that actually you're powerless over people, places, and things? Well, the first place that you can't turn to is yourself, because we've discovered that you have no capacity. I have no capacity to influence this person in my life. I have no capacity to go back in time and change what I experienced as a child. Right. But then what do the 12-step programs say? Well, they say that you have to come to believe in and then come to accept the help of what? A higher power, something higher than yourself. Now, what does that mean? It's going to mean something inevitably different for different people. But at the end of the day, what it's trying to direct you to is the fact that your powerlessness means that you need to accept help from something else. And so for some people, that higher power, quote unquote, will be the wisdom that they find in the rooms, the sense of communion that they have with other people, being able to share their story and experience that sense of acceptance from other people. Then, of course, it also, for many people, should involve some conception of being able to hand one's problems over to something higher. And I would think here in terms of a literal classical god of some sort. I think philosophically that, in my view, is the most respectable way of understanding reality. But more than that, I think that, at least for me, that's the way that I've engaged with the programs, that you accept your own powerlessness and it forces you to recognize that there's something higher than yourself that must be able to rescue you, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like realizing that you were powerless over your parents' alcoholism?
Distinctly unpleasant, I suppose.
I'm sure.
And I mean, it's kind of, it's the sort of thing where we don't behave rationally. We don't have one experience where we go, well, I didn't seem to have much control over this situation, so I'm going to accept my powerlessness and try and accept into my life some sort of higher power. No, we don't do that. We persist in our ways of acting. We persist in trying to control other people's lives or control alcohol or the substance in our own lives. Because that's the way we work. We keep on making the same mistake over and over again. So for many people, myself included, I found that it really took getting to a kind of lowest ebb or a dark night of the soul to come to accept my own powerlessness over people, places, and things, alcohol and other issues like that.
And the dark night of the soul, that's such an interesting phrase you've used there. So what did that look like for you?
Well, for me, what it was I was not living as the person that I was created to be. I was not living a happy, intellectually fulfilled life. I was living a resentful, anger-filled life where I was hurting the people around me, where I was getting involved in arguments and problems that I had no business to be a part of. And in that sort of situation, one knows in their heart, I was not living as I was supposed to live. So it took living like that for long enough to come to realize that there's got to be something better for me to be doing.
So, I just had an idea there, but I've forgotten it. So there's this idea that we're powerless, and yet we've got some things that we can control, or, well, don't even like using that word, but we're powerless, but we have choices. We can choose certain things. So you've just described how, even given your existential powerlessness, you're capable of making certain choices against, in this case, emotions that you talked to, or behaviors.
Yeah.
How hard is that, and what sort of help do the 12 steps give you with that?
Well, look, I tend to think about a lot of these issues in terms of the serenity prayer, which says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. And so in that prayer, what do you have? You have this sort of formula for regaining a certain aspect of your own freedom. And so what you mentioned there is emotional control. And so what I think about when we're thinking about emotional control is we're thinking about the ability to accept things that we cannot have an influence over. And so, again, this is something that we've known since the Hellenistic period, since the Stoics, since the ancient Greeks as well, is that there's going to be all sorts of things that we don't have control over. People, places, and things, right? So what happens when you're under the illusion that you're able to control those sorts of things? Well, what happens is that you get emotionally tied up with what people, places, and things are doing. And so, in essence, what's happening is they're having an emotional influence on you, and your actions are not having an influence on them, at least not in any positive respect. So what happens then when you choose to accept that, okay, I'm not powerless over so many things in my life? What happens? You gain back the emotional control to respond in a rational way, to respond to those things in a way that is not governed by their influence over you.
Mm-hmm.
And going forward, what do you kind of hope to change, if anything, about yourself and, I guess, day-to-day, your daily practices and your relationship with your parents?
Yeah. Well, I suppose what I hope to do is, in effect, practice the program better so that I can be a better son, so that I can be a better friend to my friends, so that I can be one day a better spouse, a better father.
Is that the goal, ultimately?
Yeah, that's one of the goals. That's one of the goals, certainly. But I think here what you've got to think about, in the case of alcoholism, particularly in a situation like mine where you're an adult, an adult child of an alcoholic, so you grew up around alcoholism, there's all sorts of impacts that alcoholism has had on you that you're still carrying around in all sorts of strange ways. And so you've got to be prepared to accept that you've got to go on a bit of a journey to try and understand how alcohol has had an influence over you, and then to try and change your behaviors, your thought patterns, and your emotional responses, so that you don't pass on those kinds of vices and traits and problems to the next generation, to the people over which you have an influence.
I'm going to go straight to intimate relationships now, because that's where a lot of the damage is done, because it's about trust and control and stuff. Can you talk about how that's manifested for you? Have you seen any connections with that, how you are in those relationships?
Yeah, definitely.
Yep.
I mean, without going into too much of the gory details, you put your finger on it. I mean, it's the question of control. When you grow up around alcoholism, you want control over things. You want control over people. You want control over people, places, and things. And so the hardest thing to accept when you've allowed someone to penetrate so deep into your emotional life, as we do with our intimate relationships, is that you ultimately don't have the right or responsibility of governing this person's life. I mean, of course, in a relationship, there's all sorts of give and take, and that's an important part of a relationship. It's an important part of a healthy relationship. But what happens when you're tremendously influenced by the presence of alcoholism in your life is that your tendency to want to influence the other person gets completely out of whack. And so the slightest sign of them going off the rails gives you the sorts of warning bells that you might have had as a child when your parents were going off the rails. The slightest sign in my own intimate relationships that my girlfriend is not living well or is not living up to who I think that she could be, for me is an indication that everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket, mm-hmm. as it did when mm-hmm. I was a child. So you tend to respond to that by going, look, I know best. Just let me control your life. Let me do everything. And, you know, understandably, that's not going to be good for a relationship. No one wants to be in a relationship with a tyrant.
If I could just jump in. So you were pretty much saying if you could see things that weren't happening or unfolding in the way that you think that they should, you have the tendency or the desire to want to control that, or it gives you some kind of grief. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience in the past. However, Al-Anon and Alateen before it helped teach me how to escape those kinds of inherited emotional and behavior patterns, right? So that's the tendency. That's kind of the hand you've been dealt because you grew up around alcoholism. Okay, that's not your fault. But at the same time, I have now the capacity to understand what's going on and to behave differently. And part of that, as we were speaking about just before, is coming to accept that you don't have control over people, places, and things. And when you can do that, you can be in a much better position to have a healthy relationship.
That authenticity thing's important there too, because another thing that you gain by going to meetings and understanding that it's okay to be completely authentic, it means that in an intimate relationship, if you are getting all feelings are irrational or non-rational, but if you if the panic stations are starting because the person looked in a certain direction or ate a certain whatever it is that's caused you to have the panic, that you can say that to the person rather mm-hmm. than don't do that, mm-hmm. but yeah. I'm starting to feel worried about this or something, and then it is expressed properly mm-hmm. and not in an unhealthy way.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And again, what that represents is the fact that you've taken a step back from the situation. You've taken a step back and you can actually detach and view what's going on sufficiently to be able to then communicate as a rational actor rather than just an emotional force, mm-hmm. you know, and that's important in a relationship. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like you are an emotionally intelligent person, and I feel like some of that may have come from Alateen and being able to discuss your feelings in this manner. Have you found that it's helped you in your relationships, being able to discuss intimate issues?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, part of that is just my character. I think part of that influences my work as a philosophy student and has influenced my musicianship as well. I mean, authenticity, emotional authenticity, is an incredibly important part of any attempt to communicate with anyone. Right, so none of really what we're saying here is going to be restricted to the domain of intimate relationships. There's going to be cross-pollination here with any kind of relationship that we're going to have, because people want to see that you're honest. People want to see that you're able to communicate what's really going on for you, not in a burdensome way for other people, but in a manner that represents that you have a certain amount of control and understanding over what's going on for you internally, so that you can actually influence other people in your actions in a beneficial way.
But going back to art as well, I feel like that's what makes any good art enjoyable. It's the authenticity.
Yes.
And it's the fact that the artist is clearly trying to connect with people through their work.
Definitely. I would agree. Yeah. Authenticity and craft. You know, it's got to be part inspiration, part, you know, emotional discharge. But at the same time, it's doing that in a controlled and sort of virtuous manner, if I could put it that way.
So it's a great idea, isn't it, to think that the trauma through the 12 steps, the trauma of addiction, whether it's your own addiction or the impact of someone else's addiction on you, can lead you to this wisdom, that this hard-won wisdom that's, you know, as you say, goes back to Marcus Aurelius and mm-hmm. the Stoics and Socrates and everything. Mm-hmm. What a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What a wonderful way to bring up a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really why I feel so lucky for having been given the opportunity to go to Alateen, because in those formative years, you're looking for some kind of guide or some kind of compass to tell you which choice to make when you come to all those different crossroads as a teenager, right? And what you have in Alateen is all kinds of wisdom, as we've talked about, being presented to you in a highly digestible form. But at the same time, it's the opportunity to make relationships with people who are also trying to govern their lives with that kind of wisdom. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, that for me, the kind of that feeling I described before, the sense of lightness or the unburdening mm-hmm. that I experienced the first time I went to Alateen, mm-hmm. that feeling itself, in a way, became my kind of North Star as a teenager, because it was a feeling of joy or pleasure in a real good, not a fake good, not something that's self-destructive ultimately, but a true good that if you pursue, ultimately will lead you to the best kind of life you can have. I'm very lucky to have had Alateen.
And I think that feelings or that state is freedom. I think it's called freedom.
Yes.
It's freedom from desire and all of that stuff. And it's why we call the show Living Free.
Right.
Nice. Right on the nose.
We're nearly done now. So keeping in mind that there may be someone listening who is a teenager, or someone listening who has got a teenager in their life that they think this might help with. What's your message? What can you say?
Yeah. Go and look and see. Because I don't ultimately think that the value of what we're talking about here can be encapsulated in some sort of set of ideas or some logical proof that I could write up on a whiteboard to convince someone to go and try Alateen or Al-Anon. Ultimately, it's something you have to experience for yourself. And if you experience that unburdening, that sense of lightness or joy, then it's going to work for you, and it's going to be a good thing in your life.
Mm-hmm. And it's not heavy philosophy at all. Many people just, they go, and what they get from it is that sitting in that room where they're not being judged and where they can speak the truth. And that in itself goes a long way, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Any final comments from Mitch?
No. I think you've summed it up really well. And, I wish we could get you on every week, you know. This has been a really fruitful conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
No worries.
Well, that is all we've got time for. So thanks again, Dan, for sharing your experience with us today. And thanks, Mitch, for your always perceptive questions.
No worries.
If you're concerned about drinking in a relative or friend and would like to find out more about Al-Anon family groups or Alateen, which is part of Al-Anon, then you can phone them on 1-300-252-666 or go online at alanon.org.au. Coming up next, we have Balam Wah, The Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Tal Jim Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.